This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
When they were first introduced, and it wasn't all that long ago, antibiotics were hailed as miracle drugs. They still are. But strains of antibiotic-resistant bacteria have been fighting back against these particular miracles for some time now, and the problem is worse in certain areas.
These are states that also tend to do poorly on other public health measures like smoking or obesity.
On today's Health Show, we'll find out how bacteria learns to fight antibiotics and where the most resistant bugs are hanging out.
We'll also find out how American food is feeding the world, and not just at Christmas time. And get some advice from the NIH on surviving the holiday season. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Since 1999, the percentage of antibiotics prescribed nationwide has dropped by an average of 17%. But there are certain areas of the country that still show unusually high rates of high antibiotic use. As a result, common infections are becoming more difficult to treat with currently available antibiotics. Unnecessary use makes antibiotics less effective in fighting off infections. Researchers at the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy, a nonprofit research group founded in 2009, have found significant national and regional trends in the overuse of antibiotics between 1999 and 2010. In 2010, the five states with the highest antibiotic use in the nation were Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana. The five states with the least antibiotic use? Alaska, Hawaii, California, Oregon, and Washington State. In fact, residents of West Virginia and Kentucky, where antibiotic use rates are the highest, take about twice as many antibiotics per capita as people living in Alaska and Hawaii. This research is part of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy's Extend the Cure campaign. Here to talk about that is the CDDEP's director, Ramadan Laxminarayan. We spoke recently, and I asked him about the Extending the Cure project.
The Extending the Cure project was conceived to address the challenge of antibiotic resistance. We've had antibiotics to treat infections only for about 70 years. So, you know, more than 70 years ago, if someone had a bacterial infection, the best you could have was, you know, chicken soup, and you prayed a little bit and you rested, and that was pretty much it, and a lot of people died. Now, antibiotics are miracle drugs because they deal with bacterial infections, but progressively over time, they've become less and less effective because the bugs have learned how to evade these drugs. And we're helping the bugs along by overusing antibiotics. So Extending the Cure is basically looking for policy solutions and looking at research and conducting its own research to figure out ways in which we can use antibiotics appropriately, you know, how we can replenish our diminishing stock of antibiotic effectiveness.
Over the past decade, we have made some progress, haven't we?
We absolutely have. So antibiotic prescribing nationwide has dropped about 17%. And this is great because antibiotic use is the single most important driver of antibiotic resistance. So this decrease has been made possible by many things, including greater awareness, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention doing more work on making doctors aware and so forth. Now, the not so great news is that this decrease is concentrated in some parts of the country, and there are other parts of the country, like, you know, the southern states, for instance, where there's been almost no decrease in use. And these were parts of the country where use was pretty large to begin with.
Yes, you do have a regional map that is up on your site, and it does show that some of the worst states are a very rural, very southern states. And is there any rhyme or reason to that, or is just how it looks?
You know, there is a rhyme and reason in the sense that these are states that also tend to do poorly on other sort of public health measures like, you know, smoking or obesity. So it's possible that there's less infection control and therefore they have more infections and therefore need the antibiotics. It's also possible that there's less awareness and therefore there's more prescribing than the rest of the country. It's hard to figure out why, but it's clear that if we need to make progress nationwide, we need to be focusing on these states.
What are some of the major problems when it comes to doctors over-prescribing antibiotics? Is it just, well, take these for preventative purposes, or is it, you know, what's going on there?
So that's a great question. A couple of things are going on there. One is typically when patients go in to a doctor, they expect something which signals the visit is over. And that something usually is a prescription for an antibiotic if they go in with something like a cough or a cold, which doesn't need an antibiotic. Even if they have a viral fever, they don't need an antibiotic. So for the doctor, it's an easy way to get the patient out of their office and to see the next patient, because they've got to see a number of patients in a single day, and time is money. Now, from the patient's perspective, of course, they do want the antibiotic, but they don't realize that when they demand an antibiotic, the doctor is much more likely to write them a prescription for an antibiotic, even when they don't need one. So this whole interaction between physicians and patients is really driving antibiotic use, just because there's not an awareness that this is not a good thing for either that individual patient or for other patients.
Is the increased use of antibiotics in livestock part of the problem?
It absolutely is. More than half, probably as much as two-thirds of the antibiotics in this country are used to make hogs and chicken grow faster than they would have without the antibiotics. And that is putting a lot of antibiotics out there into the environment, some of it to treat sick animals, but most of it really just for growth promotion. And this has significant consequences, because we're helping generate these kinds of bugs that that you could only just dream up in a lab. And then once they enter the food chain and come back into humans, they cause a lot of damage.
Well, say you find you're living in one of these areas. I guess the five states that are the worst we found are Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Say you're in Mississippi and you think you have a urinary tract infection. What should you do? Are there easy answers for doctors to prescribe drugs for that? Because, an infection like that needs an antibiotic.
The urinary tract infections, we find in our data that, and we have this tool called the drug resistance index. So what it basically is like a Dow Jones index for drug resistance. So you don't have to worry about what the bug is and so forth. This is just telling you how overall resistance is moving over time. And what we're finding is that for UTIs, urinary tract infections, resistance is actually going up significantly over time, primarily because we've had hardly any new drugs to treat these infections with over the last 10 years, and therefore it's getting progressively worse. Now, obviously, if you have a UTI, then you have to get treated for it. But we have to keep in mind that all antibiotics, no matter what we use them for, can have consequences for how resistant the bacteria are. So even if a single person doesn't have a UTI right now, they're using their antibiotics for other things, creates resistant bugs that could come back, in the form of a UTI to them. So we're all in this together, and this we have to recognize that antibiotic effectiveness is a shared resource, and it's not just about us taking our own drugs and being affected by them when it comes to antibiotics.
Well, so what can we as consumers, medical consumers, do about this problem?
Turns out quite a bit. The first thing we can all do is get a flu shot every year, because the flu season is one of the times of year when antibiotic use spikes, because people have all these symptoms and they feel they need an antibiotic for it. And that is a significant driver of resistance. The second is we could make sure that we don't demand antibiotics from our doctors when we go to them, either for a sick child or for ourselves. And then the third thing is, if we ever happen to find ourselves in a hospital situation and so forth, to really try not to get an infection by perhaps insisting that when all visitors come into your room, to make sure that their hands are sanitized. Preventing infections is the best way to reduce the need for antibiotics and therefore to reduce antibiotic resistance.
Ramadan Laxminarayan is the director of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy. You can learn more at extendingthecure.org. So just how does antibiotic resistance work? You may recall we recently spoke about that process with Dr. Alexander McAdam, an associate professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School and the medical director of the Infectious Diseases Diagnostic Laboratory.
Well, Doctor, in general terms, what are the mechanisms of antibiotic resistance in bacteria?
To understand how bacteria become resistant to antibiotics, we have to first understand how antibiotics work. Each antibiotic interacts with a specific target molecule produced by bacteria. That bacterial target molecule performs a function that is essential for the growth or survival of the bacterium. The antibiotic specifically inhibits the target molecule from performing that essential function, and so the bacteria can't grow or they die. To inhibit the target's function, an antibiotic must do three things. First, the antibiotic has to reach the site of its molecular target. Second, the antibiotic has to persist at the site of the target long enough to have its effect. Third, the antibiotic has to bind to and inhibit the target molecule's function. Bacteria become resistant to an antibiotic by preventing one or more of these three steps. So first, a bacterium can prevent an antibiotic from reaching the target either by blocking the antibiotic from entering the site of the target or by rapidly pumping the antibiotic away from the site of the target. Most targets of antibiotics are found inside the bacterial cell, and so gain or loss of a pore or pump molecule in the bacterial membrane can change whether an antibiotic will reach its target. Second, antibiotic can make enzymes that modify the antibiotic in such a way that the antibiotic is no longer active. And third, bacteria can change the target such that the antibiotic can't inhibit the target. Bacteria can do this by having a different or altered form of the target, or, less commonly, by expressing greatly increased levels of the target to escape from inhibition by the antibiotic.
Where did this all begin? Where did antibiotic resistance originate?
Most antibiotics in clinical use are derived from natural products produced by bacteria. These naturally occurring antibiotics are made by bacteria found in the environment, presumably so that the antibiotic-producing bacteria can inhibit the growth of the neighboring antibiotic-susceptible bacteria. That gives the antibiotic producers a growth advantage. Now, here's the really interesting thing. Antibiotic resistance occurs in environmental bacteria, even in bacteria that are isolated from environments that, as far as we know, contain no antibiotics from man-made processes. This reflects an arms race between different bacteria, with antibiotic resistance emerging in environmental bacteria in response to their antibiotic-producing neighbors. Also, the antibiotic producers must have ways to protect themselves from the inhibitory effects of the antibiotic they make, and so this is another potential source for the origin of genes mediating antibiotic resistance. DNA-carrying genes for antibiotic resistance traits moves between bacteria by several different mechanisms, and so antibiotic-resistant bacteria can donate these antibiotic resistance genes to other bacteria. Eventually, these genes find their way to the pathogenic bacteria that infect humans. Antibiotic resistance can also be created de novo by exposing antibiotic-susceptible bacteria to an antibiotic. This occurs through point mutations in the DNA of the bacteria, which leads to antibiotic resistance by the general mechanisms we discussed earlier. This can happen whenever bacteria are exposed to antibiotics, whether in the laboratory, the environment, or within a host such as a human or an animal.
Is anything being done to reduce the use of antibiotics in animal feed?
Several countries have banned the use of antibiotics for growth enhancement of farm animals. Sweden was the first in 1986, and they made this decision following a request from the Federation of Swedish Farmers. Several European nations have followed suit, and then the European Union banned all AGPs in 2006. Progress has been somewhat slower in the U.S. My understanding is that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, has mainly used voluntary measures to discourage the use of AGPs. For example, in April of this year, the FDA asked drug makers to voluntarily change the drug labels on antibiotics to require a prescription from a veterinarian for use in animals. The expectation is that veterinarians will refrain from prescribing antibiotics for use as AGPs. At times, the FDA has taken stronger measures. This year, the FDA restricted the use of cephalosporin antibiotics in cows, pigs, chickens, and turkeys.
Well, finally, Doctor, what other steps are being taken to combat the spread of antibiotic resistance?
Appropriate use of antibiotics in treating human infections is critical for reducing antibiotic resistance. That means using antibiotics only when they are truly needed, stopping them as soon as appropriate patient care permits, and selecting antibiotics that will be effective for a patient's specific infection without using broad-spectrum or big-gun antibiotics unnecessarily. Many hospitals now have antibiotic stewardship programs that provide education and guidance to encourage prudent and effective use of antibiotics. Another important step to slow or reduce antibiotic resistance is to prevent the spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria from one person to another person. It is really critical that healthcare personnel follow the practices recommended by their infection control group, as these practices are known to reduce transmission of pathogens in healthcare settings. Outside of the healthcare setting, We can all help fight antibiotic resistance by using antibiotics exactly as prescribed by our physicians and by practicing good hygiene, including frequent hand hygiene.
Dr. Alexander McAdam is an associate professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School and the medical director of the Infectious Diseases Diagnostic Laboratory.
Still to come, the holiday season means a lot of calls for helping feed those in need. We'll find out where a lot of that food comes from next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1289.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. The United States is the world's leading corn producer and exporter, supporting the increasing demand for meat in China, India, and other countries with growing middle classes. Those countries import livestock feed made from Midwestern grain. But as Amy Mayer reports for Harvest Public Media, feeding the world will take more than shipping protein overseas.
It's the holiday season, so you'll probably soon be hearing this 1980s pop song, which accompanied hunger relief efforts. The United States has a history of food aid, and Midwest grain certainly has its role. But sending corn, soybeans, and other food abroad is just part of the equation when it comes to figuring out how we'll feed the 9 billion people projected to be on the Earth in 2050. World Food Prize laureate and former international aid worker Catherine Bertini applauds bipartisan efforts that have refocused American food policy on farming. She spoke recently at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
The administration now, for the first time in a long time, decided, yes, it's a good idea to put more effort into agriculture development.
That means helping all farmers succeed, not just distributing food to the hungry. Governments, nonprofits, and private businesses all have a place in the effort. Seed companies, for example, are developing technologies specific to regions all over the globe. Mike Vandelot, the chief operating officer of Winfield, a Land O'Lakes subsidiary, says advances in seed technology can have global impact, and the biggest players know to innovate locally, wherever that is.
Generally, the most productive genetics are the ones that are developed within the area where the plant breeding has been done.
If your target market is China, he says, set up a lab there. And eventually, the technology will help Chinese farmers increase yield. Bertini says the U.S. government's Feed the Future program, a commitment to help ensure the world has enough to eat, emphasizes local food production. In places where people are hungry, the program supports small farming efforts because those have a ripple effect.
The World Bank says that agricultural productivity is 2 to 4 times as effective as any other productivity in alleviating poverty.
Today, the world's growing population relies on a combination of international trade, food aid from the rich countries to the poor as needed, and increased local production.
I have two high tunnels, and we use one of them for tomatoes, and then the other one for cucumbers.
We need to produce as much to feed the world as we can, but also people like to eat local, locally grown foods too. So there's a case for both sides of agriculture.
That's Boone County, Iowa farmer Greg Reinhart. This greenhouse-like high tunnel extends the growing season for some of the vegetables and fruit his family grows on 100 acres and sells at farmers markets. But on 700 acres, they grow traditional row crops.
Once we sell it, though, we don't actually know exactly where it's going, but we know it's not being wasted. It's being used somewhere in the food chain, whether in the United States or it's being exported to many countries in the world.
Given the rich soil and well-developed infrastructure here, Midwestern farmers are likely to continue playing an important role on the world food scene. But Iowa State University economist Bruce Babcock says the goal of domestic production around the world isn't as far off as many people seem to think.
The overwhelming supply of calories and food that is consumed in most countries comes from the country that is the consuming country.
So the persistent challenge is distribution. And even rich countries haven't figured out how to get food to everyone who needs it. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
You know, it's been a few years since we ran one of those How to Stay Healthy During the Holiday stories you love so much. It's about time we remedied that. From the National Institutes of Health, here's Joe Belinfi.
The holiday season can be filled with family, fun, and festivities, but it can also be a stressful time.
Holiday pressures can interrupt a person's routine and make it even more challenging to follow plans to stay healthy.
Dr. Griffin Rogers is an institute director at the NIH.
When you're getting ready to go to family gatherings and or celebrations and you know there's going to be a lot of food around, planning ahead really helps.
He recommends these tips when it comes to holiday celebrations. Don't save up for big meals. Rather, have a light snack beforehand. Keep an eye on the drinks. Alcohol in particular adds calories and enhances appetite. And go easy on dessert. He also recommends being realistic.
The holidays don't have to be perfect, but with some planning, you can help prevent some of the situations that can create stress and affect your health.
Dr. Rogers suggests making sure there are healthy foods available to eat during the holiday season and scheduling time for physical activity.
Regular physical activity during the holiday season may boost your energy, clear your mind, manage any health problems like diabetes or high blood pressure, and help you get items checked off your holiday to-do list.
He stresses the holiday season is not the time to abandon healthy habits.
Don't let the holidays become a free-for-all. Overindulgence only adds to your stress and guilt. Continue to get plenty of sleep and physical activity. And if you do overindulge in eating too much, don't be too hard on yourself. Get back on track at the next meal.
While eating favorite foods and desserts and exchanging gifts are central to many family gatherings can also be an opportunity for families to give the gift of health. Dr. Rogers says knowing your family health history can help you and your health care provider make the right decisions for your health.
Share family health history. Ask questions. Talk about common health problems like diabetes and high blood pressure, and whether anyone in the family has these conditions.
Dr. Rogers reminds that the NIH has many resources to help you and your family and friends stay healthy this holiday season. Learn more about healthy eating and physical activity from the Weight Control Information Network at win.nidk.nih.gov. For diabetes prevention and management tips from the National Diabetes Education Program, visit yourdiabetesinfo.org. And family health history and kidney disease details from the National Kidney Disease Education Program are available at nd.nkdep.nih.gov. And to hear more healthy holiday tips from Dr. Rogers, listen to episode 172 of the NIH Research Radio podcast. This is Joe Belinfi, NIH, turning discovery into health.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.